I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With less than 2 weeks until his inauguration, President-elect Barack Obama spoke today about what he called the dire state of the nation's economy. He said reforming government entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare would be a central part of his effort to control spending. Obama offered no specifics as he named Nancy Killefer as his administration's chief performance officer, a new White House position aimed at reducing government waste and improving efficiency. As Obama and the new Congress prepare a massive economic stimulus package, he said the nation could face trillion-dollar deficits for years to come.
Just today, the Congressional Budget Office announced that the deficit we are inheriting from this budget year will be $1.2 trillion. We know that our recovery and reinvestment plan will necessarily add more.
On another issue, reporters again pressed Obama to comment on the fighting between Israeli forces and Hamas in Gaza. But as he has said repeatedly, when it comes to foreign policy pronouncements, there is only one president at a time.
Until I take office, it would be imprudent of me to start sending out signals that somehow we are running foreign policy when I am not legally authorized to do so.
To talk more about this, we're joined by Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal. And Gerald, we've heard this from Obama for days now. In your view, when he does assume office in less than 2 weeks, what should he say about Israel, about Hamas and the fighting in Gaza? What can he say?
Well, what can he say, I think, is the real question, and that will depend, I think, a lot on what happens on the ground. I mean, there are two possibilities for President Obama once he comes in. This, what the Israelis are doing could either present him with immediately a huge mess, or if Israel actually succeeds and knocks back Hamas in some significant way that's seen as being a defeat for them, at least militarily, then that perhaps that leaves him with a slightly improved strategic picture in the Middle East.
You write today about this presenting a possible opportunity for Obama. Can you sort of outline that a little bit?
Sure, and I think the opportunity is long run, not short term. I think in the short term there's a mess and it's not going to be pretty. In the long run, I think the opportunity arises if a couple of things happen. If the Hamas attempt to fire rockets into Israel is seen as having brought about a real military setback for Hamas and a humiliation of sorts, that might create anger within the Palestinian community against Hamas and undercut its political legitimacy, which might open the way to more moderate leadership. And it might have the same effect of reducing the influence and impact of Iran in the region if Iran is seen as having sort of egged Hamas on to what turns out to be an embarrassing spectacle for them. Now, those are giant ifs, and it may not work out that way, but those are at least the happy outcomes that are possible.
Mm. And what about the less positive outcomes? I mean, I see this as sort of limiting his options. I mean, he comes into office and right away he's dealing with, as you say, a mess.
No, that's true. And I think in the short run, the danger is that this turns into a prolonged Israeli occupation of Gaza because the Israelis are sort of found that they've ventured into a no man's land. They can't pacify the place, but they can't leave because they haven't really succeeded in stopping the danger that they moved in to stop in the first place. So it could very well be that in a month, a President Obama looks at this situation and discovers that things have only gotten worse on all fronts as a result of what the Israelis did. And that's an equally plausible outcome to what's happening.
For the last few days, Obama's been using this language that when I assume office, I will have a lot to say. And he says with a lot of determination. As you sort of hear that and kind of read between the lines, is there an indication that a President Obama will take a starkly different tack than the current administration?
I don't know about starkly different. When I hear that, what it suggests to me is that I will be more actively engaged in diplomacy. That's one of the criticisms that you hear of the Bush administration, particularly from Arabs in the region, which is that the president himself has been too removed from this, that things don't tend to happen, particularly on the Israeli-Palestinian front, unless there's a big high-level push from the U.S. That impresses people on all sides with the gravity of the matter, and that hasn't happened. I don't know that it will be, I suspect, in fact, it won't be a markedly different approach. I think what he's suggesting to me, at least, might be a more engaged approach at the top.
Well, we'll watch that with interest. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
That's Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Washington. And now a story about love, loss, and the cost of war. In October 2006, Army First Sergeant Charles Monroe King was killed in Iraq when a bomb blew up underneath his Humvee. He died just a month before he was scheduled to come home to his fiancée and their infant son, Jordan. Sergeant King was in Iraq when Jordan was born. Before that, he was able to spend just 2 weeks with his son during a leave. But he left a legacy for his son that reminds us of the price of war and of a father's love for a son he barely knew. While he served in Iraq, King kept a journal, which he addressed to his son. And now that journal is part of a new book, A Journal for Jordan, A Story of Love and Honor. It's written by King's fiancée, Dana Kennedy, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and a senior editor at The New York Times. And Dana Kennedy joins us from NPR Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a powerful book, a sad book, of course. Why did you decide to write it? Why was it important to you to write this book?
Well, you know, the first months after Charles died, I wasn't thinking about a book or anything like that. I just was doing my best to get out of bed every day. And in time, though, I realized I had to do something with my grief. And when you're feeling so overwhelmed with emotions of fear and anger and pain, you can either do something negative or something positive. And I just felt like I wanted to do something positive with what I was feeling so that Jordan would know his father better, or at all, I should say. And so also I could maybe share a story that would humanize this war for so many people.
Tell us more about the journal itself. You actually gave the journal to Charles before he was deployed to Iraq. Why? What was your thinking there?
I was in a store actually shopping for a gift for a friend and saw it and thought, you know, he's going to war and God forbid, but there is a chance that he might not come back. And maybe he'll jot down a few messages to our son, though Jordan was not yet born, in case Charles didn't come home. I bought it and gave it to him, and he became consumed with this thing. And he took it with him to Iraq, would go out on his missions, come back late in the night, and write, and he filled up over 200 pages.
Now, the pages of the journal that you bought, when it was empty, it had questions at the top, but Charles wrote his own questions, like, why did you decide to be a soldier, or what was your most painful experience during Operation Desert Storm, in which he also served? Is there a particular journal entry you'd like to read?
Oh, yes. This is an entry from the journal that he wrote that he used to teach Jordan a life lesson about honor and character based on an experience during the war. And it says, "The 18th was a long, solemn night. We had a memorial for two soldiers from another company who were killed by an improvised explosive device. None of my soldiers went to the memorial. Their excuse was that they did not want to go because it was depressing. I told them it was selfish of them not to pay their respects to two men who were selfless in giving their lives for their country. Things may not always be easy or pleasant for you. That's life. But always pay your respect for the way people lived and what they stood for. It's the honorable thing to do."
So why do you like that passage? Do you like it because it speaks directly to Jordan and offers that kind of advice?
Here is a man who was living with life and death every day, was actually on his way to memorialize two fallen soldiers, and took the time in the heat of the desert in Iraq under those conditions to write to his baby boy to teach him a lesson about character. And I just think that it says so much about Charles's character. And Jordan will learn not only the message, I hope, that his father hoped him for him to receive from that entry, but just something about his father's fortitude. And I'm just very proud of Charles for writing the entire journal, but certainly passages like that.
Well, he wrote it, he addressed it to Jordan, of course, but I'm curious what you learned. This is also a story about your love affair with Charles. You obviously were very close to him. You guys spent 6 years together. You had a child. You were going to be married. Did you discover things about Charles in that journal that surprised you that you didn't know about?
Yes, quite a bit, actually. One of the more telling things was that Charles was this very big, muscular, imposing military guy, but he was also very shy. And so he was a man of few words. And to get this journal packed with his emotions and his feelings and some humor just was unbelievable. He wrote about the beauty of rainstorms and rainbows. He told our son it's okay for boys to cry. He went in depth about why he loved me. It was just incredible. You know, he told him about the power of prayer. And so I actually fell in love with him all over again when I read this journal.
When did you actually get to read it?
I read it a few months before he died. He sent it to me initially unfinished because one of his young soldiers was killed in a tank and he had to recover the young man's body from the tank, and it shook him up and it got him thinking about his own mortality. And so he sent the journal to me. He called me and said, I'm going to send it to you incomplete, but I think there's enough in there that if something happens to me, Jordan will have it. And then he came home in the end of August of 2006, just 6 weeks before he died, to meet our son, and that's when he finished the journal.
Can you tell us how Charles died in Iraq?
Yes, he would have been home in a month, and he was in charge of quite a number of soldiers, many of them very young, many of them it was their first tour in combat. And so he would often accompany them on missions that were really low-level missions. And this particular mission was one to resupply a base. And they were bringing food and batteries and water and so forth. And this day, he allowed one of his young soldiers to stay behind, and he went in the Humvee instead in the middle of the convoy so that he could show his troops, I'm here with you. I'm not going to ask you to put yourself in harm's way if I don't do it. And an improvised explosive device was detonated under his Humvee.
Now, this theme that you just brought up about Charles recurs through the book. He's a very dedicated soldier, very dedicated to his men under his command. That wasn't always easy for you, was it?
It was not. I obviously respect and appreciate it greatly, and I'm proud of him for it, but at times it required tremendous sacrifice for our family. For example, he had promised me that he was going to take his leave and come home when Jordan was born, to be there for the birth, and I was arranging to be induced around that time to make that happen. And then a couple of weeks before, he called and said, Dana, I just can't come. He said, my troops are just getting settled here. They're scared, some of them, and I can't leave them. And so he sacrificed being at the birth of our son to stay there with his soldiers. And in a way, he was a father to them as well.
A moment ago, you described his death taking a risk that he didn't have to take. I mean, he had to take it out of a sense of duty, but he didn't actually have to take it in terms of military orders. And I'm wondering, is there a part of you that is mad at him still for taking these risks that ended up with his losing his life?
I actually did go through all the stages of grief that people talk about and that you read so much about. And the first was denial, and I really didn't believe it was true. And then there was a part of me that was incredibly angry with him. You know, here I was with a brand new baby, and he went out on this mission voluntarily and left us. And I know that that was just the grief, and I moved beyond that stage, and I have nothing but pride and love for him now. But I did, as part of my grieving for a time, spend it, you know, angry at him.
And we're talking to Dana Kennedy, a senior editor at the New York Times. Her new book is A Journal for Jordan, A Story of Love and Honor. Our conversation with her continues in a moment. Later in the show, a small college in Illinois takes a different approach to bad economic times. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Dana Kennedy about her new book, A Journal for Jordan, A Story of Love and Honor. It tells the story of her fiancé, Army First Sergeant Charles King, who was killed in Iraq and who left a journal for their infant son. And Dana, Charles was killed, we've mentioned, when a bomb exploded under his Humvee. You write that you weren't really satisfied with the Army's description of that incident. What did you learn about his death that was important for you to understand?
Well, because I'm a reporter, I was able to ask for the right documents, and I was able to interview his soldiers. And the official story is that he died immediately, and I'm not sure that that's true. I think that when possible, the military says that to sort of try to relieve your grief a bit. But I think Charles actually lived for 15 or 20 minutes, bleeding internally before he died, and his soldiers described that to me, a number of them. And I had to sort of reorder in my head what happened to to him because I thought he had this death that was very swift, where he went basically from an earthly world to a heavenly world. And then I had to reorder what I thought. And I thought, wow, did he feel the pain? Did he maybe in his delirium wonder where I was? And so that hurt. That took a while for me to come to terms with.
You say very little in this book about your views of the war. Charles was a dedicated soldier. You make it clear that he never questioned his orders or his commitment to the mission. And as a journalist, you say that you're used to remaining neutral about sort of political questions. But I have to ask, did you two ever talk about the wisdom of the war? Did that ever come up in conversations that aren't reflected in your book?
Very briefly, because for him, the war was not about weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't about an axis of evil at all. He trained these soldiers. Soldiers cared for them very deeply, like they were his own sons. He was much older than many of them. He was 48 years old when he died, and had been in the military for 19 years and had served several tours of combat. And so that was his focus, getting those soldiers home. And I asked him one day what a typical day in Iraq would be like for him. And he said everything from making sure my men get their mail to recovering their bodies. And the truth was, once he got his orders, the politics of it didn't matter. He was going. And he was so focused on first getting them ready and then bringing them back. And my focus was his morale.
Sure. Can I ask you, how do you feel about the war now?
I still hold the same view that I don't think it's appropriate for me to say, one, because I'm a journalist, but also I don't want the message of what this book is about to be lost with answers to a question like that. This book is about heroism and honor, and Charles is just one soldier. There are so many more serving so honorably in Iraq and Afghanistan who never have books written about them, and I was hoping that if I tell our story that personalizes the war in some way, and I just really don't want the message to get lost. Obviously, we all have feelings about the war, but I wanted to highlight, instead of that, my pride about our soldiers, and this one in particular.
Sure. Let me ask you about your son. Remind me, how old is Jordan now?
Jordan's 2.5 now.
And do you have any sense when you will show him the journal?
I actually have two decisions to make. The first is when to show him a journal for Jordan, the book that I wrote, which is literally written to him. Every chapter starts, "Dear Jordan." That's my first decision. And this book was meant for him as a young man. I say in the first chapter that you're only 10 months old now, but I'm writing this for the man you will be. But the journal itself, the document that his father wrote for him, is meant to guide him through life. That's why Charles wrote it. Part of it is written for a very young child, part for a teenager, and part for a man. And so I want Jordan to grow with that and feel like he's having a conversation with his father all along his life. And so I've read a couple of passages to him, but I think I'll start sharing more of it with him in the coming years, very soon, maybe 4 or 5 years old.
2.5 years old, it's still very, very young to sort of process the idea of a father at war and losing a father. What kind of conversation have you had so far with him?
This is the most painful part of this now for me. Jordan asks at least 2 or 3 times a week where his father is. And I think that started because he would hear kids in the playground saying, "Daddy," and he'd yell out, "Daddy." And I remember one time a little girl said, "That's not your daddy, that's my daddy." And in his preschool recently, they were talking about what they were thankful for Thanksgiving, and many of the kids said, "My mommy and my daddy." And so those kinds of situations prompt him, I believe, to ask. And I tell him that his dad lives with God now, but that he loves him and he always will love him. And Jordan said to me recently, "Mommy, I'm mad at Daddy." And I said, "Well, that's okay. You're allowed to be angry with him. But I think once you learn about him, you're really going to love him." And I said, but why are you mad?" And he said, "Because he's far, far away." And that's about the extent of it. But I think that the fact that he asks so often means that it's on his mind and he just doesn't have the language skills to ask more specific questions at this point.
In addition to the journal, Charles left behind some wonderful pictures. He liked to draw. And I'm thinking specifically of this great picture of an angel. And I'm wondering if I mean, I can imagine a two and a half year old looking at those pictures and getting something out of that.
The angel print actually hangs over his bed, but the story behind that is that Charles had attended the Chicago Art Institute for a time and specialized in pointillism. And so he created this with tiny dots of ink. And he has hundreds and hundreds of drawings that he made. But he very rarely drew pictures of himself. And he gave this to me right before he deployed while I was still pregnant. And I looked at it and I said, "Charles, this is you." I said, "I don't want it. It really shook me up. This is a picture of you as an angel. I don't want this. You're coming home." And I shoved it in a closet and left it there until after he died. And now I have to tell you, I'm really relieved to have it.
Let me ask you to read one more passage from the book,
sure,
if I could. At the bottom of page 265, it's you writing to Jordan, and it includes another brief passage from Charles's journal to Jordan.
This is actually the last page of the book. There is an epilogue that follows, but it says, "I will never be the same person I was, but I will be whole again in time. What I pray for most is to be the kind of mother Charles deserved for his only son. My prayer for you, Jordan, is that you carry with you the knowledge that you will always have two parents guiding you through life. I will rely on a mother's intuition to show you the way, but that alone will not be enough to teach you to be a man. For that, I give you your father's journal and the wisdom it contains. I will do my best to be the best example of a strong black man physically, mentally, and spiritually," Charles wrote. Mission accomplished.
Well, Dana Kennedy, thank you so much for coming in and talking about your book.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Dana Kennedy's book is A Journal for Jordan, A Story of Love and Honor. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the shortage of families willing to adopt and the debate over gay and lesbian adoption. That's tomorrow. We'll be back after the news, Here and Now. The recession is being felt just about everywhere, including at colleges and universities across the country. Endowments are down, schools are cutting costs, and in many cases putting a freeze on faculty hiring. But Augustana College, a small liberal arts school in Rock Island, Illinois, is bucking the trend and taking a gamble by launching a faculty hiring binge. Jeff Abernathy is vice president and dean at the college. He wrote about his decision to expand his faculty despite the recession in this week's Chronicle of Higher Education, and he joins us now from his office in Rock Island, Illinois. Good to have you, Dean Abernathy.
Thanks very much for having me.
So tell us why you're choosing this moment to expand your faculty. Surely Augustana College isn't immune to the current economic conditions.
We are not. It's true, though, that what Warren Buffett says, to be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. This is a moment when, for Augustana, we felt we must invest in our faculty. We've been hiring in the last 5 years. We've increased our faculty by about a quarter in the last 5 years, moving from 143 to 181 full-time faculty. And we wanted to increase that commitment to full-time faculty, even as we recognize the market and even as we're making cuts in other areas of the campus.
In the essay, you call this hiring binge the greatest gamble your college has taken in a generation. How big a gamble, and why take such a gamble?
It is a considerable gamble because, of course, we can't know where our enrollment numbers will be come this fall. We don't know exactly where the market will be either, and given those two questions, we could have done as many colleges have and frozen the hiring, determined that we had to be more conservative. But the reason to go ahead is that the faculty are the heart of a liberal arts college like Augustana. They ensure that our students have a tremendous experience as they learn and grow and prepare for graduation and for rich lives of service to their community. And thus, we felt it was imperative for us to continue with our plans for hiring.
Dean Abernathy, besides just a continual quest for the best faculty, are there particular reasons why you want to increase the size of your faculty?
There are. Our student body has grown by about 10% in the last 4 years, and our faculty has grown by about 26%. And that growth is essential to keeping the small classrooms that are the essence of a liberal arts education that are critical for our students' learning and growth. We've also added new programs like one called Augie Choice that gives graduates the skills they need to become productive employees and graduate students. These programs that give them options in research and international travel and internships. It's this kind of growth that faculty hiring supports, and these are essential reasons that we had to go forward this year.
And give us a sense of what the faculty to student ratio is at Augustana.
At Augustana, the student-faculty ratio is 11.2 to 1, the lowest it has been in modern times. That is a key goal of our strategic plan, and that's been reduced each of the last 5 years.
So you're determined to keep that faculty-student ratio low.
We know that when students come to graduate, that the essence of their experience is that work with faculty, that close connection that they develop with faculty, and it's the small classrooms that enable that.
Now, Augustana is a private college. Can you tell us what tuition, room and board cost your students?
Yes, all told, it's around $38,000 for next year.
And we've heard that applications to state schools, where tuition is considerably lower, are way up these days. Does that mean you're seeing a reduction in applications, or is that a concern that you have?
That's certainly a concern that we have. We are very pleased with our applications this year, which are, in fact, up over previous years. They're at a record level at this point, and that is because we've made some moves. We, for instance, have announced the lowest tuition increase in 25 years at Augustana. We announced that months ahead of when we normally would because we know that families are hurting in this crisis right now, and we are concerned for them. We want to let them know that we are going to keep college affordable. And likewise, of course, we provide substantial scholarships to the greatest number of our students, so that it's very few who pay that full amount.
Mm. Now, I read that, like many colleges and universities, your endowment is down, but you've decided not to freeze faculty hiring. What steps are you taking to save money in other ways?
We've taken a great number of steps. Our endowment is down from a high of about $110 million to $80 million today. And so we've announced that smallest tuition increase. We've likewise delayed a building project. We had plans to go ahead with a student center this coming May, and we've determined that we must not go ahead with that because of this economic crisis. We've likewise already made budget cuts across the campus, and we've made contingency plans for additional cuts. Our retention committee, too, has made individualized plans for each and every at-risk student, and we are contacting those students to ensure that they continue to see the value of an Augustana education.
Mm.
Across campus, we're cutting back on travel and wherever else we can.
Now, I'm curious what kinds of applicants you're getting, because it occurs to me, and I'm sure it's not lost on you, that with so many schools cutting back and imposing hiring freezes, you must be getting a pretty good pick of applicants for these open positions.
We have been delighted with the pools, which in some cases have been double what we might normally have expected. This is one product of the hiring freezes across the country that, yes, our pools are very substantial, that we've got incredibly strong applicants from across the country and indeed around the globe. And we recognize that this year gives us an opportunity to introduce many more new PhDs than we might normally to what a liberal arts education is all about and to what it might mean to teach in an environment such as ours.
Hmm. But are you getting faculty applicants who might otherwise have overlooked you before? In other words, in a more robust economy, they might have gone to bigger, better-known colleges and universities, and this gives you an opportunity to go after them.
I think that's exactly the case, that we are seeing that many of those who are now graduating with their PhDs are taking a look at a liberal arts college like Augustana because perhaps there aren't the opportunities that there might have been otherwise. And what they're finding, we hope, is that one can be a teacher and scholar in an environment like this and have a terrific career and balance that career with one's life beyond the college in a way that is deeply appealing.
And what are you hearing from other deans, other college administrators? Do they think that your strategy here is a little unorthodox, maybe even a little crazy, or what do you hear from them?
I think some do, and certainly we've heard on campus from department chairs who wonder if I've read the news. But across the country, I think there's a balance. I think some number of liberal arts colleges certainly are continuing with the searches that they had planned, might be cutting back on any additional ones. But there are freezes as well among liberal arts colleges, as clearly there are among most of the state schools and many of the research institutions generally.
Well, Jeff Abernathy, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
That's Jeff Abernathy. He's vice president and dean of Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. He wrote about his decision to expand faculty hiring in this week's Chronicle of Higher Education. As always, we love to hear your thoughts about our program, so get in touch. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. You can also give us a phone call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Again, that number is 617-358-0397. Remember to include your full name, phone number, and where you're from. And still ahead today, one woman's daily challenge, living with bipolar disorder. You're listening to Here and Now. And now, a David and Goliath story. In this case, David is the tiny British island of Sark, located in the English Channel, one of the Channel Islands. Sark is 3 miles long and 1.5 miles wide and home to just 600 people. Until recently, it was governed by hereditary landholders and was considered the last feudal state in Europe. Residents get around the island by bike or horse cart, and most of them want to keep it that way. But not everyone, and that's where the Goliath comes in. Two billionaire brothers, David and Frederick Barclay, who own the Daily Telegraph, built their own private castle on a neighboring island. Since then, they've been buying up businesses on Sark, where they hope to develop a more upscale way of life. Some on the island supported their efforts and ran for election to the island's local legislature last month, but they lost. That pleased residents like Jennifer Cochran, who writes for the local paper on Sark. And Jennifer, tell us what it is about the island that you think needs to be preserved.
Sark is a small, unspoiled island. We don't have paved roads. We don't have streetlights. We don't have cars. And the Barclay brothers had a vision of a rather sanitized tourist attraction. They wanted to pave the roads and introduce streetlights. And they were very insistent that we should have a helipad.
Now, the folks who were in favor of this kind of development, they lost in this last election. How have the Barclay brothers reacted to this loss?
Once they realized that their favored candidates were not going to be elected, they closed down their hotels and they sacked their workforce. That didn't surprise us because they've actually done that twice before when chief pleas have taken decisions that they didn't like.
The chief pleas is the local legislature.
Yes. Right.
Can you describe in a little more detail the way of life that you and other Sark residents are so eager to defend?
Well, our island is extremely beautiful and very peaceful, and until relatively recently was a splendid working community. But in recent years, a lot of the tenement, Sark has its own tax laws, and they are very generous. Because we have no bureaucracy on the island, there's not a great deal that Sark itself has to pay for. Most people work voluntarily, and so the taxes are very low. So people with a lot of money want to come and live here. And so very slowly, the sort of people who had a seat on chief pleas were changing. They were not people who worked for the good of Sark and for the love of Sark, and they didn't really understand how the island worked.
And they were in favor of the kind of development that the Barclays were encouraging?
A lot of them were. A lot of them were employed by the Barclays, and they could see the Barclays as a source of income in future years.
Well, what about that? Don't you need income and don't you need jobs on Sark? I mean, those in favor of the Barclays were saying that they were providing much-needed jobs in hotels, restaurants, and so on and so forth.
Well, that is absolute rubbish. Sark was not in any trouble. We have never had unemployment on the island. They've made it easier for some people to get jobs.
Sure.
But they sacked 140 people, they say, when they pulled out after the election. Of those 140 people, 38 were locals. The rest were the Barclay brothers had brought in to do the work they wanted. And of those 38, practically all of them had jobs within the next 4 days.
So you don't need the Barclays?
We don't.
And
the Barclays need us because of our tax laws, but we don't need them.
So do you think you've heard the last of them? I mean, that is their effort to develop Sark into a sort of modern tourist destination, which sounds like that's what they want to do.
They want to bring in extremely high-paying tourists, which the island, in fact, won't sustain. We don't have a central water supply here, and they wanted to put in a hotel with a golf course that needed 5,000 gallons of water a day to keep the greens green. Well, we don't have that kind of water.
Well, do you feel, Jennifer Cochran, we characterized this at the beginning in the introduction as a bit of a David versus Goliath story. Is that the way it feels to you?
Well, it does indeed, because what we don't have is what they have, which is vast quantities of money But in fact, they have mistook the island. They thought that because we were a small island, we would be very easily bought. And it doesn't work like that here. Money is relatively unimportant here. What matters is the community life. A lot of the families that are on the island have lived here since 1565. And of course, they wouldn't vote the way that the Barclay brothers wanted them to vote. They voted the way they wanted to vote.
That's Jennifer Cochran. She's a resident of the island of Sark in the English Channel. Jennifer, thank you.
Not at all.
It's Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. In the late 1990s, author Maria Hornbacher wrote the best-selling book Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia, which told of her long battle with eating disorders. But as she reveals in her latest book, Maria also suffers from manic depression or bipolar disorder. She struggled with it her entire life, though it wasn't diagnosed until she was 24. As we hear in this reading, when Maria finally learned she was bipolar, it filled her with horror and hope.
I have a word, bipolar. Now it will be better. Now it has a name, and if it has a name, it's a real thing, not merely my imagination gone wild. If it has a name, if it isn't merely an utter failure on my part, if it's a disease, bipolar disorder, then it has an answer. Then it has a cure. At least it has something that should help. And then the horror sets in. All that time I wasn't crazy. I was, in fact, crazy. It's hopeless. I'm hopeless. Bipolar disorder, manic depression. I'm sick. It's true. It isn't going to go away.
That's Maria Hornbacher reading from her book, Madness, A Bipolar Life. We spoke to her when the book was first published last spring, and we thought we'd revisit the conversation today. As Maria told us, her illness wasn't diagnosed for a long time, but it had manifested itself when she was a small child.
My parents can say that even at the very, very earliest ages, I just refused to sleep. I was wild a lot of the time. As I got a little older, into my 4, 5, 6 years old, I would go through deep funks and then wild periods where I wouldn't speak, would run around speaking wildly or going into deep silences, just the basic mood swings that you see in bipolar.
Hmm. And what did your parents think? If it wasn't diagnosed then as bipolar, what did they think it was?
At that time, so little was known about mental illness and almost no acknowledgement was made that children would have mental illness. And so my mother has always said that they just kept saying, well, this maybe is a sensitive kid or a hyperactive kid, or maybe she's just very, very moody.
Mm. Can you describe what would happen to you when you were manic?
There is this feeling of something welling up in you that requires speed. You want to drive 1,000 miles an hour. You want to jump out a window. You want to binge on drugs and alcohol. You want to do anything just to burn this energy off. In a mental sense, you want to write and write and write, or talk and talk and talk. When it gets to extreme levels, you can go into psychosis.
So it really can become destructive.
Incredibly destructive and dangerous.
For a long time, you were treated for depression and you were prescribed the antidepressant Prozac.
That's right.
That made it worse, right?
It did. Prozac, for many, many people, triggers mania. For me, since I didn't have depression, it counteracted any depressive episodes I might be having, but rocketed me into severe mania.
And this went on for years.
Many years.
Many years. You were also being treated for eating disorder. In fact, as we've mentioned, you wrote a book, Wasted, about your eating disorder. How that must have complicated the understanding, the diagnosis in a huge way.
I think in many ways it blocked the ability to diagnose the bipolar because it was the pressing, life-threatening issue at the time. Of course, many, many people with bipolar suffer from eating disorders, addictions, other secondary diagnoses.
You weren't actually diagnosed until the age of 24. It's quite a scene in the book when you finally have this meeting with a doctor who recognizes your condition. But after your diagnosis, your condition gets worse. Why?
Because I choose not to do anything about it. I thought, I'll take the meds when I want them. If I want them to help, I won't take them when I don't want to. I was very cavalier about it. I really assumed that my life was chaotic, would always be chaotic. There was no other way to live. And of course, that meant that I couldn't conceptualize what would happen if I did try to manage it. I didn't try to manage it for another almost 10 years.
Mm. And in that period of time, so you went off and on the medications, and you were drinking a lot as well.
Yes,
I was. And that's going to make it even worse.
It means the medication won't work. And, of course, with bipolar, putting alcohol on it is like gasoline on a fire.
Hmm. In your book, you wonder how your life might have been different if you'd followed the doctor's orders immediately. How might it have been different?
What could have happened is that I could have had another 10 years where I was living in some peace, where I was learning gradually, as I am now, to manage this day by day, to live a normal life day by day with a mental illness. Instead, my mental illness ran absolutely rampant, damaged my life, damaged other people. I have a lot of regrets I'd like not to have.
Hmm. How did you finally manage to start managing it? And we're going to talk about what it takes to continue to manage it now, but how did you finally make that transition?
When I got to the point where the alcohol was killing me, and someone did finally get it through my head that if I didn't stop drinking, I would never be able to manage the bipolar. It would get worse and worse, and then I'd wind up dead. I really went, okay, I have no choice. I don't know how else to live, but something's got to change.
Hmm. What are you doing today to manage your bipolar disorder? In the back of the book, you list current medications, Lamictal, Tegretol, Geodone, Wellbutrin, Trazodone, Ativan, and a number of supplements that are thought to support mood stability, including a high dose of fish oil and strong vitamin B complex. A lot of pills every day.
It is a lot of pills every day. It's between 20 and 24.
Really? Wow.
Without the medication, you cannot function with severe bipolar. It is not possible. Mm. I also meditate. I do yoga. I go to therapy. I take long walks. I take baths. I get massage. And all of those things are critical. But without the medication, I'm a lost cause.
We were chatting a little bit before we recorded, and I told you I've been close to somebody with this disorder. And I was struck by the fact that he was prescribed lithium, which is the usual prescription. And this is a drug that dates back to 1948. So the fact that they're still prescribing lithium to treat this disorder tells me that not a whole lot has been done to really understand the best way to treat it. Is that correct?
It's fairly accurate. There are not a lot of medications out there that work better than lithium for some people. Lithium really only works in about 50% of cases, and it doesn't work on the depressive end of bipolar. There are a number of other medications, especially Lamictal, that are emerging as prominent mood stabilizers and effective mood stabilizers that do treat the depressive end. Lamictal is actually an anticonvulsant. So are some of the other major meds. They don't have, at this time, a way to specifically target the errant chemicals and neurotransmitter issues that exist in your brain with bipolar.
Hmm. Do you find yourself dealing with the temptation, again, to go off these medications? Because, again, this is what I've experienced with a couple of people who I've known to suffer from this disorder. And that is, the manic episode has an almost seductive quality to it, at least the beginning.
The temptation of mania is always there. You can't stop yourself, though, once you get up. There is no limiting how high you'll go. It's going to be completely up to the bipolar itself. And so at this point, I have no temptation not to be on my meds. I need to write books. I need to have a marriage. I need to see my friends and family. I have a life now that's very, very valuable to me. And without the meds, I can't have it.
Finally, and you're just sort of touching on this final point I wanted to ask you about, what becomes so clear is that this is something that you have to manage forever. You can't cure this. What are the implications of that as you think about that?
As you look ahead at your future and you see this day after day, high maintenance management, tracking of the moods, the meds, the days where you aren't functional, the days where you're hyperfunctional, knowing that your family and friends are always looking at you a little bit askance to see if you're starting to lose it. My response to it really is to feel a minor exhaustion. When I go into the hospital, it's a much greater exhaustion. There's a great deal of frustration. It's tiring. It's tiring.
Author Maria Hornbacher, her book is Madness, A Bipolar Life. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, Karen Pellin, Hitesh Hati, and Jill Ryan. Doug Sugertz is our technical director. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Jesse Martin and Hillary Niles. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. And the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow, Here and Now.